We're discussing shared custody and the journey of co-parenting after a divorce. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Navigating a divorce is tough, and with kids involved, it means thinking about what's best for the entire family. The pandemic added all new challenges to the emotional and psychological stress. Are you a parent who shares custody of your child or children? What's it been like for your family in these times? What issues have you had to work through with your ex-spouse? Were you able to find common ground? 800-642-1234. Jan Blackstone is a retired child custody mediator for the Superior Court of California. She co-authored the recent book called Co-Parenting Through Separation and Divorce, Putting Your Children First. Jan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. So lay it out for us, if you will. What are some of the issues facing co-parents during these times in this pandemic?
You know, people ask me that all the time, like there's supposed to be some special issues. And the thing with the the pandemic that's really accentuated the need to co-parent is the fact that under crisis, parents have to get along well enough to problem solve for their children. And the pandemic just made that more obvious, more important, that parents have to have a plan in place to understand how they can problem solve so that their children, there's not added stress to their children's issues.
Sounds like the key piece of this is communication back and forth between the parents.
You know, that the people who want to get along do. People who don't want to get along don't. That's what I tell people. You look for a way to get along if you need to. And that's exactly what it is. Communication. You have to figure out how you can talk to somebody with respect, no matter what they've done, so that you can problem solve together.
Have custody agreements evolved at all since the pandemic started? You know, you're seeing, as you say, the same issues coming up, but what do custody agreements look like in these times?
They're the same. I mean, what you're doing is a custody agreement is you share your children. If parents are really working together, they have to ask themselves, is it in the best interest of my child to go back and forth at this point? Are there elderly parents, you know, like grandparents living with the parent who has shared custody? So will the child, you know, possibly infect, you know, the grandparent? Those types of things needed to be taken into consideration. But now that things are opening up and people are getting their vaccines and things are slowly getting back to normal, if you can at least talk to each other, then you can compromise.
You mentioned vaccines, and, you know, of course, children will eventually be able to get the COVID vaccine once it's made available. But what are you hearing as far as how parents are choosing to settle a debate about whether to put a mask on that child and when that mask goes on and whether they will vaccinate?
Well, those are two different considerations. Masking is a law. At this point in most states where you go out, now it depends on if the child is really small, then they don't have to. But that is a subject that they have to discuss. And if you're asking me, how do you solve that problem? You know, that's a difficult one because you can't stop somebody from doing something that's not against the law when the child is with them. Mm-hmm. You can't pick from afar. Now, in terms of vaccines, that's an issue that I've seen when I work for the court system, where sometimes people, and it doesn't have anything to do with the pandemic. You know, it's some people vaccinate, some people don't. And in that case, I've seen judges have to make the decision for the parents. What they ask them to do is bring in all the information that they have. So the judge can look at the information that the parent has, because they want to make sure that the parent is fully educated on their position. And then the judge will make the decision. And most of the time, I have to say, I've seen them pass the judgment that they will get vaccines.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jan Blackstone, who's a retired child custody mediator for the Superior Court of California. We're looking at the challenges of co-parenting and child custody, not just in the pandemic, but of course, all the time. You can join in with your questions, your insights. Are you a parent who shares custody of your child? What's it been like during the pandemic? Have certain issues come up? Where have you found common ground? 800-642-1234. Jan, you know, there's been this long stretch of virtual learning for many children, and considering there are still kids who maybe one or more days a week home learning virtually, how are divorced parents navigating these issues in the virtual space?
Well, I can only tell you that parents report to me that it's incredibly stressful, and it adds to the stresses of raising a child in a pandemic, because oftentimes parents allow the teacher to take care of all the education, and this back and forth between parents complicates homework and things like that, even when there isn't a pandemic. So now they're navigating, you have to stay in touch with the teachers far more, you have to communicate more, and all these things are the types of things that I'm explaining that, you know, this is why parents who are no longer together have to communicate with each other. If there's a trauma, if there's a crisis like this, you can't just let your child flounder.
How do you suggest negotiating issues in front of a child and not, you know, playing this tug of war, if you will, that the child has to negotiate? How do you communicate well in front of the child?
Well, you make sure that you are very aware that the child is listening, and everything you're saying, children are like sponges. Everything you're saying makes a difference. And you also, if the child, I would possibly say, you know, Jason's listening right now, and I want to make sure that we, you know, negotiate in good faith. So let's put this some other time. And I would then explain to the child, because you don't want to make sure, you want the child to see oftentimes that you can negotiate well. But I'm kind of digressing, but I wanted to say that I often counsel parents to negotiate in front of the child on purpose, have an agreement already in mind. Already, you know what, you understand what I'm saying? So that they can see a positive way to problem solve. But you can't just do that by the skin of your teeth, because if you're really angry, you don't want the children to watch you negotiate when you're really angry at each other. But there were times that my husband and I used to stage apologies, for example. Because we wanted the children to see how you apologize and how you accept an apology graciously. So we would stage it if we started to argue, you know, we'd go away. Because what kids see is they see the argument. They don't see the negotiation to end the argument, because the parent goes in the other room, or they go in the bathroom and they scream at each other and they come back out. So we would come back out and say, gee, honey, I'm really sorry that I said that in that way. I should have said this. And then he would say, well, thank you for saying that. I accept your apology. So, you know, that's what I would do, because if you're fighting in front of the children, you're teaching your children to fight with their spouse.
Well, it seems like, you know, you're putting successful problem solving skills on full display there for those young people. Yeah.
Exactly. But I also have some tips for parents who don't have to talk, who negotiate, you know, co-parenting, where the kids aren't around, and how to negotiate that. I always tell parents to come to the table with one problem and a solution for the problem, so that when you're negotiating with something, you have an idea of how to problem solve. Just don't lay it on the table and say, you always do this. Mm-hmm. You know? You have to have an idea of how you want to problem solve. And that gives the other parent a place to start the negotiation.
Yeah. So there's, you know, kind of finding those openings, but also coming to the table with ideas yourself on how to get to a resolution.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Couldn't said it better myself.
Jan Blackstone is with us, specializing in co-parenting, counseling, conflict resolution, child custody, divorce. Did you get a divorce amid the pandemic? Do you have children? What was the process like? Did you work through a mediator on shared custody? What issues are you working on now? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Jan Blackstone here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing co-parenting and shared custody situations in the pandemic. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Glad you could be here. Attorneys interviewed by the New York Times last month, they described a slowdown in divorce filings, that there was this peak in the early days of the pandemic, and in recent months, a slowdown. Have you gone through a separation or divorce recently? What proceedings could you initiate over Zoom? How are the kids doing? What agreements are you still trying to work out with your ex on co-parenting in the pandemic? Join in your question, your situation, 800-642-1234. We have child custody mediator Jan Blackstone, who stays with us for 10 more minutes. Jan, let's talk contracts, drawing up in writing what your expectations are. How important is it to draw up a contract, write it out, to clearly state those expectations between the parents?
Oh, really good question. And after the break, I was going to mention this. So great, good segue. I am the director of a nonprofit organization called Bonus Families, and bonusfamilies.com has a 300 articles on this subject. And one of the articles is a contract specifically to kind of help parents walk through the process and have an agreement on how to problem solve. And the reason I always say at the bottom of the contract to sign it is because you have proof that you both were there and negotiated this contract. And they're the kinds of things where, you have an idea, you agree that you'll go to a public place and negotiate, don't go to each other's homes, don't drink alcohol while you're doing it, or smoke something, because that alters your consciousness and you may be less likely to negotiate. These are all the types of things that you have to consider, and you make an agreement, you check off the boxes, and you sign the contract at the bottom.
And so, you know, this can be a laundry list, if you will, of items that are important to each spouse. There isn't
Absolutely.
A limit. Yeah.
No, it's your, see, the thing about co-parenting or parenting, but specifically co-parenting, is you can design the relationship that you want to have with your ex or your partner. I often don't use the word divorce, just to let you know, because the more people have children without marriage, outside of marriage, than they have being married now. And people are sticklers about words. So, and when I say divorce, most people will say, well, we were never married. But they still have the same custody issues. Custody and the divorce proceedings are two separate issues.
Yeah. You have said that you want parents to help parents to stay out of court on custody issues. What is that court experience like?
Well, you know, I help people stay out of court because they're afraid to go to court. But I mean, sometimes that's the only way to have a problem solved. Mediators and judges are there every day to help people. They don't want to see you in court either. They would like you to problem solve yourself, because the court system doesn't want to raise your children. But sometimes that's what has to be done, and the court system is there to help people.
So when you do go to court, what are some of the tips that you have for families, for parents who do end up in court? How should they approach it?
Well, document everything. So what your problem is, you know, and make sure before you go to court, make sure you've talked to your child's other parent about the problem. Oftentimes people just file because they're mad, and it's something that could have been discussed and solved very quickly. But if it's an ongoing issue, make sure you document things. That means when the child was with you, when the child was with the other parent, what was said, text messages, Facebook posts, anytime you vent and say something incorrect that you shouldn't be saying, that's still admissible in court. So, have those types of things. I've seen people bring in derogatory text messages, and the judges just completely come unglued, because that's incorrect way to negotiate. Mm. And it proves that person is not willing to negotiate. And if a judge has to make a decision where a child will go, they will make the decision in the favor of the parent who is most likely to foster the relationship with the other parent.
You know, you've been a mediator many years. Mm-hmm. When you sit down with a couple, with parents, how do you keep an open mind? How do you not take sides when you hear their stories?
I ask them to put a picture of their child in the middle of the table.
Huh.
They always have them on their phone.
Yeah.
And I put that in. I mean, sometimes you can't help it. I mean, if somebody is incorrect, I mean, is abusing a child in some way, and I'm not talking about sexual, sometimes their attitude is abusive or their words are abusive, then I come out and tell them, what do you think you're doing? You know, and explain to them what a child thinks when they say those things. But if for all intents and purposes, is if the parents are equal in their, for want of another word, rightness, then we just talk about it from the child's point of view.
And putting that child's picture in the center of the table, what does that do to the conversation, to the tone?
Oh, absolutely. When somebody starts really, arguing with the other parent, I pick up their phone and show them the picture. I said, this is why you're talking. This is the reason. And that changes the attitude because then they realize that it's all about the kid. It doesn't matter what happened. If they have shared custody, they have to figure it out. If there was a problem so bad that there wasn't shared custody, then they don't have to negotiate because the courts have already said one parent has all of the rights. But 9 times out of 10, and I'm just throwing out that number, but it's pretty close. I rarely do I see sole custody because the courts believe that a child deserves both parents. So the court, the law is putting the child in between these two parents, and it's up to the parents to be parents, and not babies.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with longtime child custody mediator Jan Blackstone as we discuss the challenges of co-parenting and what it means in the pandemic. Taking your questions, your situation, 800-642-1234. Jan, let's touch on child support. The Office of Child Support Enforcement announced last year that it's okay to modify but not waive specific timeframes for certain child support services. What should a parent do if they can no longer pay for child support?
Go back to court because with all of their documentation, call the court.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be afraid to call the court. They're not going to raise your child support. If anything, they'll work with you. I mean, look at how many people work with their employees or employers because of the pandemic. If you're not making any money, how are you going to be able to pay child support? The court system knows that. So they will do something. I mean, I don't know. I just always tell people that to go back to court and not be afraid, because if you don't have money, you don't have money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Child support is based on a computer program, based on what you make and your time allotment with the child and how much the other parent makes and their time allotment. And they put all this information in a computer and it spits out an amount. It's not arbitrary. Say, a lot of times people say, well, that, she hit me up for so much child support. Well, it's because you make a lot of money. So that's the reason. But if you no longer make money, then you need to go back to court and talk to the judge or the Department of Child Support Services.
How are child support money, how is this money used in the family? Can you tell us a little bit about where you see it going?
Well, I mean, child support is designed to be used for the child,
mm-hmm.
to ease their life and make their life much more comfortable. But oftentimes it seems to be fathers, but now, I mean, mothers oftentimes make more money than fathers. So they're paying child support, but most of the time it's fathers paying child support to mothers. And I often hear them get very upset because they think that the mother is, because they're so angry at them anyway, is using the money to go to Tahiti. I often say, and then she's got a new car. You don't know where she got the money for the new car. I had a client who had that happen, and it was a company car. She got a new job, so that's where, again, where communication is. He's angry that she's got using the money to buy a new car when it was a company car. She's using the money for rent, that type of thing. So don't go to assumptions. And when you are writing this child support check or transferring the money, think of the child. Picture the child in your head, not the ex, because you're giving them money for the child, and it will make things easier. You won't feel that animosity welling up in your chest when you're thinking about, giving this money for your child instead of the ex.
Jan, in our last moments together, how might the pandemic affect co-parenting in the future? Have we learned anything from this experience?
You know, I hope so. The pandemic has given me an opportunity to speak out and given parents an opportunity to see the importance of working together. It's really has been an opportunity to put your best foot forward. It's been terrible. I mean, especially for people who, you know, live alone. And I'm not just talking about, you know, in custody situations, but for seniors and things like that, where people live by themselves. This has been the mental health component to the pandemic. It's been awful. But it's also given us a way to work together and see the importance of working together.
Jan, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Jan Blackstone is a retired child custody mediator for the Superior Court of California. Ahead this hour, we discuss the next stage in the Twin Cities Milwaukee-Chicago Inner City Passenger Rail Project. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Public health officials hope most people will want the COVID-19 vaccine, but they know some won't, and that may determine whether the pandemic ends. Shemaine Mills has more.
As the state begins to roll out a public education campaign to get more people vaccinated against COVID-19, it's approaching a turning point in the pandemic where vaccine supply could soon outstrip demand. Until now, Wisconsin's had just the opposite problem. Demand has been high, however, supply was sometimes uncertain, and health officials repeatedly urged people who wanted a shot to be patient. State health officials have pegged July 4th as the time when 80% of Wisconsinites could be vaccinated if the state's vaccine supply from the federal government remains steady and people remain eager to be vaccinated. The first to get immunized are what Department of Health Services Deputy Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke calls early adopters. So far, just over 20% of people in the state are fully vaccinated.
I think it's going to be a little bit harder once we get over 50 to 60%. We may need to encourage a lot of people to get vaccines, so it may take a little bit more time.
Where they live may play a role in how receptive people are to that message. In January, polling from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that rural Americans were most likely to be hesitant to get vaccinated. Amanda Marsh lives in rural Brown County on 10 acres with her husband and their 5 children. The backyard is near a wetland, which is busy with blackbirds and geese this time of year. While she's not ruling out a change of heart, the 39-year-old Marsh said no one in the family plans on getting vaccinated against COVID-19.
I don't know that taking something that does not have long-term studies on it is the right decision for me. I honestly would probably have a lot of anxiety if I was to take it.
Health experts say the vast majority of side effects that happen with any vaccine occur in the first 3 months, and there's no reason to believe these vaccines are going to be any different. The vaccines have been tested on tens of thousands of people in clinical trials. Millions have been inoculated, and complications have been rare, says Dr. Pat Remington, a UW-Madison professor who used to work for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Well, it's understandable that people are concerned about long-term health effects of the vaccine because it hasn't been around a long time. But if there were considerable risks down the road, we would already be seeing those.
State and national efforts to encourage people to get vaccinated will include sports figures, clergy, and word of mouth, focusing on both rural and urban areas. On Monday, the Brewers announced players were vaccinated over the weekend. And Ben Weston, Director of Medical Services for Milwaukee County, says everyday people can be part of the effort too.
And after you've received your vaccine, be the ambassadors to your community. Reach out to your friends, to your neighbors, to your family. Let them know why you chose to be vaccinated.
Amanda Marsh doesn't think she'll be convinced. She has relatives who work as nurses and says some have gotten the vaccine, others have not. Same goes for her friends. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has advised everyone to get vaccinated as soon as they're eligible. Medical professionals say this is the way to not only protect yourself, but others. How that message is presented is key. Marsh wants people to be educated, not shamed.
I think implying that people don't care if they don't get vaccinated about everybody else is just blows my mind, because that is not where I stand. And I want nothing bad to happen to you. I just have to do what's best for me.
But medical experts say the odds are against those who choose not to get vaccinated for COVID-19, a disease where the risk of death and long-term medical complications exceeds what might happen if someone gets a vaccine designed to prevent that. Shemay Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we check in on passenger rail service between Chicago and St. Paul via Milwaukee's Intermodal Station, the TCMC project. It stands for Twin Cities Milwaukee Chicago Intercity Passenger Rail Project. It adds a second daily round-trip train service on Amtrak's Empire Builder route. This is a 411-mile corridor. Have you taken a trip on the Empire Builder? What can you share about the experience? Would you support more passenger train travel in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. Arun Rao is passenger rail manager at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Arun, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks very much, Kate. It's great to be here.
Well, let's look at this Chicago Twin Cities corridor. What is the need for a second trip? What do you see on ridership?
Yeah, so Amtrak's Empire Builder, which travels once daily between Chicago, Milwaukee, La Crosse, St. Paul, and then on to Seattle and Portland, has had strong ridership within that Chicago to Twin Cities segment of the corridor through Wisconsin. Often coach seats sell out and there's limited capacity to meet demand. And people are trying to use that service for regional travel as opposed to long-distance trips to, you know, Seattle, Portland. 70% of people getting on and off at Wisconsin stations are traveling to destinations within the Twin Cities to Chicago segment of the Empire Builder. So demonstrating some demand for regional trips there. And the single round trip really limits the viability for many regional trips. For example, you can't make a one overnight trip to the Twin Cities for a business meeting. And with the additional schedule, you'll be able to do that.
Oh, also, so coming back the same day, this will make it possible to come back the same day.
One overnight trip, not the same day, but
okay,
one overnight.
One overnight. Yeah, yeah. What else do you see? Because this is, you know, a corridor with a number of smaller cities, regional cities.
Yes. And so it's especially important for those communities, for smaller urban communities and rural communities, in terms of the economic impact from that. It's really on several levels where it enables them to leverage the rail service better to attract and retain businesses and jobs in their communities. Also brings people into those communities who are using the station, coming in from surrounding areas and going into local businesses. But it really strengthens the connection between those communities and the economic epicenters of the region of Twin Cities, Chicago, and Milwaukee. And that's a really you know, powerful thing for the smaller urban and rural communities along the route.
Yeah. So with more service comes construction. What is required for this second line?
Yeah. So the additional trip will use existing track, but okay, adding two additional passenger trains on what's essentially a single track railroad with sidings takes up capacity between Milwaukee and Minnesota. So there are some railroad track improvements needed. One project is in Wisconsin, and that's in La Crosse. And then there are four in Minnesota. And these are what a federal grant that Wisconsin DOT has received will help get constructed.
Yeah, so, you know, let's talk funding here for a moment. This project is funded largely through the Federal Railroad Administration grant, and Amtrak has put in money. What must Wisconsin and Minnesota kick in on this project?
Sure. So the it's a Federal Railroad Administration grant for about $32 million, and that's for the improvements in both Wisconsin and Minnesota. And Wisconsin's match is about $6.3 million, and Minnesota's match is $10 million. Amtrak is putting in $5 million of that.
And so what is the total cost of this project?
It's $53
million. $53 million. Where are you at in the timeline of adding this service?
Well, we are. We have the federal funding needed for the track improvements. We need to secure. We're securing the state matches, we also have federal funding to offset the first 3 years of operating support that would be needed, which greatly reduces the burden on the states to fund that during the startup period. And then we are complete with preliminary designs for those improvements. And service and operating plans are complete. Environmental documentation is just about complete and should be wrapped up in about a month or a month and a half here. And then we'll be ready to execute grant agreements, agreements partnering with the other states, and go into final design and construction pending the securing of the funding.
Okay. And so construction might be out a couple years or so?
Yeah, we're looking at, if all goes well with securing the funding, a 2022 final design and then 2023 and 2024 construction with service starting in late 2024.
In the comment period that's coming to a close tomorrow, how will the comments that you get inform this project?
Yeah, so we'll be looking at those comments and considering all of them. We've really seen we're getting a lot of comments, which is fantastic. We've got about over 3,200 comments so far, and we've had that comment form up since middle of March. And of those, we're seeing broad support, 75% in favor, another 10% leaning in favor. We'll be looking at all of those comments. There's a lot of good comments. We've also received comments in the form of letters of support from the business community, from the communities themselves, from stakeholders all across the state. So we're hearing from a lot of people, which is good, and it's going to make the implementation of the project better.
Well, it sounds like you're getting a lot of support through these comments and what you're hearing from the business community, from residents. What does that momentum do for this project?
I think it really it does help move things along. It helps with communication. It also helps with securing the funds, and it helps when as we move forward looking at the operational details of how this service will operate as well.
We're talking with Arun Rao, who is passenger rail manager at the state DOT. Do you work for Amtrak? Would you like to see more investment in passenger rail? What questions do you have about the second trip from Chicago to the Twin Cities? And hey, Milwaukee, do you take trips into Chicago on the Hiawatha? What is that like? What are your tips? Still time to talk. Rail, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Arun Rao here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about the prospect of adding more service in coming years on the Twin Cities Milwaukee-Chicago rail corridor. The public comment period, as we've been talking about on the TCMC project, closes tomorrow. The service would follow Amtrak's existing Empire Builder train route. This is 400-mile rail corridor with station stops including Columbus, Portage, Wisconsin Dells, Toma, La Crosse in there. Arun Rao is passenger rail manager at the Wisconsin DOT. He stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Thomas now in Waukesha. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering whether or not there's been any consideration of adding stops. A good concern would be Watertown. It's a growing community. There's a lot of stuff going on there. And it's been neglected over the years, and during the Milwaukee Road Days was an important stop.
Thomas, thank you. Arun, what about adding additional stops?
Sure, yeah. So the currently the proposed Twin Cities Milwaukee Chicago service would stop at all of the existing both Hiawatha Service and Empire Builder stops. And we're right now, you know, that, I mean, compared to the Empire Builder doesn't serve all of the Milwaukee, Chicago, Hiawatha stops. This would stop at the Milwaukee Airport. So it's really a matter of travel time as well for Amtrak and the desire to keep travel time down, to keep it shorter than what the current Empire Builder takes. And adding a station would add that travel time. So currently no plans to add any additional stations at this time, but this is more focused on adding that frequency for those existing stops.
Well, Thomas brings up Watertown, but when will rail service loop in your Madison, your Eau Claire, your Green Bay, cities not served by passenger rail in any convenient way, shape, or form?
Sure. So we're focused right now on the existing improvements to these existing services and adding frequencies to make them more valuable and meaningful to Wisconsin. We have the effort to increase frequencies on the Milwaukee, Chicago, Hiawatha service that we're working on. And then we have this federal funding, and we really want to deliver on increasing the frequency here on the Twin Cities to Milwaukee to Chicago corridor. I do understand that there's a lot of questions about that, but right now we are focusing on adding these frequencies.
Yeah, how is the Hiawatha line doing, which runs from Milwaukee to Chicago? How is ridership there?
Well, in 2019, before the pandemic hit, and in the years prior to that, we've just been seeing off-the-charts ridership growth, reaching record high in 2019 of over 880,000 riders that year. And I know people that ride that service regularly can attest those peak trains can get pretty busy. So there has been long been an effort to increase frequencies on that service. So currently it's 7 round trips, and we are working on trying to get that increased to 10 round trips daily.
Well, let's go to Tom now, joining us in Madison. Hi, Tom. What would you like to add?
Good morning. I guess a lot of what I would like to talk about has been discussed in the last response to the last caller, but I think it is important to integrate transport modes. And in the case of Madison, we still need a light rail system here, and we still need a station at the airport that could presumably be served by this line. I just have to state here that as upset as I am as a state employee with Governor Walker and the passage of Act 10, his truest and largest mistake and undermining of the Wisconsin economy was his rejection of the high-speed rail project. The need still exists. We don't have as much federal money. We won't have, you know, the same caliber of transport. And that guy just ruined everything.
Okay, and Tom, let's look, Arun, at high-speed rail. And, you know, this is still something, as Tom says, just very much on the minds of Wisconsinites.
Yes, and I do understand that. But again, right now we're able to deliver on these significant, meaningful improvements on the existing corridors that have been needed for a long time. And so that's the current focus. But I did want to touch on one point that Tom talked about, was integrating transportation modes. And that's really a big part of what this is about, too. It's not just about the rail Twin Cities Milwaukee Chicago project, not just about the rail line itself, but about connections to better connections to other scheduled services like intercity bus. And with this additional schedule option, we can better connect to intercity bus across the state. This also includes dedicated shuttle bus service from that we want to look at from the Eau Claire area, west central Wisconsin, to Toma for trips to and from Chicago. Similarly, you'll see on the map there that we want to look at Madison area, Dane County to Columbus connections to see if that would work. So we're really able to get this moving, hopefully, to improve the entire inner city system.
Building off the infrastructure that you have as a base. Arun Rao is with us, passenger rail manager at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Anne is joining us from St. Louis. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi. I think it's a great idea. We are getting older, and personally, driving on bad roads in the middle of winter to go skiing is a second thought now where it never used to be. And if there was something like into Minnesota, that would be great. Get off the train, rent a car, and we're off. And there are other places that we've used the train in the same way, and it works out really
well. Oh, I think we just lost Anne. Anne, though, very much in favor of being able to just take the train and get off when she needs to. Arun, are you hearing comments like that?
Absolutely, yeah. We're hearing a lot of those comments. A lot of people who both choose not to drive or cannot drive and who are looking for options and options that work better for them. And, the additional frequencies is the biggest driver of ridership and the usability of the service. So I think this will help with a lot of those issues.
I used to ride the Texas Eagle quite a bit to Dallas and so forth, up to Chicago. But there's such a big issue with yielding to freight and getting delayed so often. Is this a problem on the Empire Builder corridor?
Yeah, so the Empire Builder's on-time performance is pretty good going westbound from Chicago. It's originating in Chicago, goes over the Metra track in Illinois, and then Canadian Pacific Railway in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and they do a fantastic job in dispatching passenger trains. But when the Empire Builder is coming from Seattle and Portland, it has to traverse multiple freight railroads as it goes across the country, and so the eastbound Empire Builder heading to Chicago can experience significant delays, and that's one thing, and that that hinders regional trips and hinders people trying to make business trips, and it hinders connections to other modes. And so this Twin Cities Milwaukee Chicago service will originate in St. Paul, will not have to traverse over so many railroads, will be on Canadian Pacific rail for most of the journey. And so the on-time performance of this eastbound train is expected to be a lot better than the current eastbound Empire Builder train.
Arun, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Arun Rao is passenger rail manager at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. We have a link to the TCMC project. Can comment there, WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, it's a conversation about classical music with WPR's Lori Skelton. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us for The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.